21. The Shells by Moonlight. 1. We had no trouble negotiating the road home. The smell was still there, but it was better now, partly because a good wind was getting up, blowing in off the gulf, and partly because it was just better now. The courtyard lights of El Palacio were on a timer, and they looked wonderful, twinkling out of the dark. Inside the house, wiremen went methodically from room to room, turning on more lights, turning on all the lights, until the house where Elizabeth had spent most of her life glowed like an ocean liner coming into port at midnight. When El Palacio was lit to the max, we took turns in the shower, passing the water-filled flashlight from hand to hand like a baton as we did so. Someone was always holding it. Wireman went first, then Jack, then me. After showering, each of us was inspected by the other two, then scrubbed with hydrogen peroxide where any skin was broken. I was the worst, and when I finally put my clothes back on, I stung all over. I was finishing with my boots, laboriously tying them one-handed, when Wireman came into the guest bedroom looking grave. "There's a message you need to hear on the machine downstairs, from the Tampa police. Here, let me help you." He went down on one knee before me and began tightening my laces. I saw, without surprise, that the gray in his hair had advanced, and suddenly a bolt of alarm went through me. I reached out and grabbed his meaty shoulder. "The flashlight, does Jack—" "Relax. He's sitting in Miss Eastlake's old china parlor, and he's got it on his lap." I hurried, nevertheless. I don't know what I expected to find, the room empty, the unscrewed flashlight lying on the rug in a puddle of dampness, maybe, or Jack sex-changed into the three-eyed, claw-handed bitch that had come falling out of the old cracked keg. But he was only sitting there with the flashlight, looking troubled. I asked if he was all right, and I took a good look at his eyes. If he was going wrong, I thought I'd see it in his eyes. "I'm fine, but that message from the cop—" He shook his head. "Well, let's hear it." A man identifying himself as Detective Sampson said that he was trying to reach both Edgar Fremantle and Jerome Wireman to ask some questions about Mary Iyer. He particularly wanted to speak to Mr. Fremantle if he had not left for Rhode Island or Minnesota, where Sampson understood the body of his daughter was being transported for burial. "I'm sure Mr. Fremantle is in a state of bereavement," Sampson said, "and I'm sure these are really Providence PD's questions, but we know Mr. Fremantle did a newspaper interview with the Iyer woman recently, and I volunteered to talk with him and yourself, Mr. Wireman, if possible. I can tell you over the phone what Providence is most curious about, if this message tape doesn't run out." It didn't. And the last piece fell into place. 2. "Edgar, this is crazy," Jack said. It was the third time he'd said it, and he was beginning to sound desperate. "Totally nuts." He turned to Wireman. "You tell him." "Un poco loco," Wireman agreed, but I knew the difference between poco and muy, even if Jack didn't. We were standing in the courtyard, between Jack's sedan and Elizabeth's old Mercedes. The moon had risen higher, so had the wind. The surf was pounding the shore, and a mile away the shells under Big Pink would be discussing all sorts of strange things. Muy asustador. "But I think I could talk all night and still not change his mind." "Because you know I'm right," I said. "Tu perdón, amigo. You might be right," he said. "I'll tell you one thing. Wireman intends to get down on his fat and aging knees and pray you are." Jack looked at the flashlight in my hand. "At least don't take that," he said. "Excuse my French, boss, but you're fucking crazy to take that." "I know what I'm doing," I said, hoping to God it was true. "And stay here, both of you. Don't try to follow me." I raised the flashlight and pointed it at Wireman. "You're on your honor." "All right, Edgar. My honor's a tattered thing, but I swear on it. One practical question. Are you sure 2 Tylenol will be enough to get you down the beach to your house on your feet? Or are you going to wind up doing the crawly gator?" "I'll get there upright." "And you'll call when you do?" "I'll call." He opened his arms then, and I stepped into them. He kissed me on both cheeks. "I love you, Edgar," he said. "You're a hell of a man. Sano como una manzana." "What does that one mean?" He shrugged. "Stay healthy, I think." Jack offered his hand, the left one. The boy was a learner, and then decided a hug was in order after all. In my ear, he whispered, "Give me the flashlight, boss." In his, I whispered back, "Can't. Sorry." I started along the path to the back of the house, the one that would take me to the boardwalk. At the end of that boardwalk, 1,000 or so years ago, I'd met the big man I was now leaving behind. He'd been sitting under a striped umbrella. He had offered me iced green tea, very cooling. And he had said, "So, the limping stranger arriveth at last." "And now he goeth," I thought. I turned back. They were watching me. "Muchacho," Wireman called. I thought he was going to ask me to come back so we could think about this a little more, talk it over a little more. But I had underestimated him. "Vaya con Dios, mi hombre." I gave him a final wave and walked around the corner of the house. 3. So then I took my last great beach walk, as limping and painful as my first ones along that shell-littered shore. Only those had been by the rosy light of early morning, when the world was at its most still. The only things moving, the mild lap of waves and the brown clouds of peeps that fled before me. This was different. Tonight the wind roared, and the waves raged, not alighting on the shore, but committing suicide on it. The rollers further out were painted chrome, and several times I thought I saw the Percy from the corner of my eye, but each time I turned to look, there was nothing. Tonight there was nothing on my part of the gulf but moonlight. I lurched along, flashlight gripped in my hand, thinking of the day I had walked here with Ilsa. She had asked me if this was the most beautiful place on earth, and I had assured her that no, there were at least 3 others that were more beautiful. But I couldn't remember what I'd told her those others were, only that they were hard to spell. What I remembered most clearly was her saying I deserved a beautiful place, and time to rest, time to heal. Tears started to come then, and I let them. I had the flashlight in the hand I could have used to wipe them away, so I just let them come. 4. I heard Big Pink before I actually saw it. The shells under the house had never been so loud. I walked a little farther, then stopped. It was just ahead of me now, a black shape where the stars were blotted out. Another 40 or 50 slow, limping paces, and moonlight began to fill in the details. All the lights were out, even the ones I almost always left on in the kitchen and Florida room. That could have been a power outage caused by the wind, but I didn't think that was it. I realized the shells were talking in a voice I recognized. I should have. It was my own. Had I always known that? I suppose I had. On some level, unless we're mad, I think most of us know the various voices of our own imaginations. And our memories, of course. They have voices, too. Ask anyone who has ever lost a limb or a child or a long-cherished dream. Ask anyone who blames himself for a bad decision, usually made in a raw instant, an instant that is most commonly read. Our memories have voices, too. Often sad ones that clamor like raised arms in the dark. I walked on, leaving tracks behind me that featured one dragging foot. The blacked-out hulk of Big Pink grew closer. It wasn't ruined like Heron's Roost, but tonight, it was haunted. Tonight there was a ghost waiting. Or maybe something a little more solid. The wind gusted and I looked left, into its pushing force. The ship was out there now, all right. Lightless and silent, its sails so many flapping rags in the wind, waiting. "Might as well go," the shell said as I stood in the moonlight, now less than 20 yards from my house. "Wipe the blackboard clean. It can be done. No one knows it better than you. And just sail away. Leave the sadness behind. If you want to play, you gotta pay. And the best part? The best part is I don't have to go alone," I said. The wind gusted, the shells murmured, and from the blackness under the house, where that bony bed lay 6 feet deep, a dark shadow slipped free and stepped into the moonlight. It stood bent over for a moment, as if considering, and then began to come toward me. She began to come toward me, but not Percy. Percy had been drowned to sleep. Ilsa. 5. She didn't walk. I didn't expect her to walk. She shambled. It was a miracle, a black one, that she could move at all. After that last phone call with Pam, you couldn't call it a conversation exactly, I'd gone out Big Pink's back door and snapped the handle off the broom I used to sweep sand from the walk leading to the mailbox. Then I'd gone around to the beach, down to where the sand was wet and shining. I hadn't remembered what came after that, because I didn't want to, obviously. Only now I did. Now I had to. Because now my handiwork was standing in front of me. It was Ilsa, yet not Ilsa. Her face was there, then it blurred and it wasn't. Her form was there, then it slipped toward shapelessness before firming up again. Little pieces of dead sea oats and bits of shell dropped from her cheeks and chest and hips and legs as she moved. The moonlight picked out an eye that was heartbreakingly clear, heartbreakingly hers, and then it was gone, only to reappear again, shining in the moonlight. The Ilsa shambling toward me was made of sand. "Daddy," she said. Her voice was dry, with a grating undertone, as if there were shells caught in there somewhere. I supposed there were. "You will want to, but you mustn't," Elizabeth had said. "But sometimes we can't help ourselves." The sand girl held out her arm. The wind gusted and the fingers at the end of the hand blurred as fine grains blew off them and thinned them to bones. More sand skirled up from around her and the hand fattened again. Her features shifted like a landscape under rapidly passing summer clouds. It was fascinating. Hypnotic. "Give me the flashlight," she said. "Then we'll go on board together. On the ship, I can be the way you remember me, or you don't have to remember anything." The waves were on the march. Under the stars, they roared in one after the other. Under the moon, under Big Pink, the shell spoke loudly, my voice arguing with itself. "Bring the buddy, I win. Sit in the chum, you win." Here in front of me stood Ilsa made of sand, a shifting houri by the light of a three-quarter moon. Her features never the same from one second to the next. Now she was Illy at 9. Now she was Illy at 15, headed out on her first real date. Now she was Illy as she'd looked getting off the plane in December. Illy the college girl with an engagement ring on her finger. Here stood the one I'd always loved the best. Wasn't that why Percy had killed her? With her hand held out for the flashlight. The flashlight was my boarding pass for a long cruise on forgetful seas. Of course, that part might be a lie. But sometimes we have to take a chance, and usually we do. As Wireman says, we fool ourselves so much we could do it for a living. "Mary brought salt with her," I said. "Bags and bags of salt. She put it in the tub. The police want to know why. But they'd never believe the truth, would they?" She stood before me with the thundering incoming waves behind her. She stood there blowing away and reforming from the sand beneath her, around her. She stood there and said nothing, only holding her arm outstretched to take what she had come for. "Drawing you in the sand wasn't enough. Even Mary drowning you wasn't enough. She had to drown you in salt water." I glanced down at the flashlight. Percy told her just what to do, from my picture. "Give it to me, Daddy," the shifting sand girl said. Her hand was still held out. Only with the wind blowing, sometimes it was a claw. Even with sand feeding up from the beach to keep it plump, sometimes it was a claw. "Give it to me and we can go." I sighed. Some things were inevitable, after all. "All right." I took a step toward her. Another of Wireman's sayings occurred to me. In the end, we wear out our worries. "All right, Miss Cookie. But it'll cost you." "Cost me what?" Her voice was the sound of sand against a window, the grating sound of the shells, but it was also Ilsa's voice, my if-so girl. "Just a kiss," I said, "while I'm still alive to feel it." I smiled. I couldn't feel my lips, they were numb, but I could feel the muscles around them stretching just a little. "I suppose it will be a sandy one, but I'll pretend you've been playing on the beach, making castles." "All right, Daddy." She came closer, moving in a queer, shambled drift that wasn't walking, and up close the illusion collapsed entirely. It was like bringing a painting close to your eyes and watching as the scene, portrait, landscape, still life, collapses into nothing but strokes of color, most with the marks of the brush still embedded in them. Ilse's features disappeared. What I saw where they had been was nothing but a furious cyclone of sand and tiny bits of shell. What I smelled wasn't skin and hair, but only salt water. Pallid arms reached for me. Membranes of sand smoked off them in the wind. The moon shone through them. I held up the flashlight. It was short, and its barrel was plastic rather than stainless steel. "You might want to look at this before you go giving away kisses, though," I said. It came from the glove compartment of Jack Cantori's car. The one with Percy inside is locked in Elizabeth's safe. The thing froze, and when it did, the wind off the gulf tore away the last semblance of humanity. In that moment, I was confronting nothing but a whirling sand devil. I took no chances, however. It had been a long day, and I had no intention of taking chances, especially if my daughter were somewhere. Well, somewhere else. And waiting for her final rest. I swung my arm as hard as I could. The flashlight clamped in my fist and Nan Melda's silver bracelet sliding down my arm to my wrist. I'd cleaned them carefully in the kitchen sink at El Palacio, and they jingled. I had one of the silver-tipped harpoons stuck in my belt behind my left hip for good measure, but I didn't need it. The sand devil exploded outward and upward. A scream of rage and pain went through my head. Thank God it was brief, or I think it would have torn me apart. Then there was nothing but the sound of the shells under Big Pink, and a brief dimming of the stars over the dunes to my right as the last of the sand blew away in a disorganized flurry. The gulf was once more empty, except for the moon-gilded rollers, marching in toward shore. The Percy had gone, if it had ever been there. The strength ran out of my legs and I sat down with a thump. Maybe I'd end up doing the crawly gator the rest of the way after all. If so, Big Pink wasn't far. Right now I thought I'd just sit here and listen to the shells, rest a little. Then maybe I'd be able to get up and walk those last 20 yards or so, go in and call Wireman. Tell him I was all right. Tell him it was done, that Jack could come and pick me up. But for now I would just sit here and listen to the shells, which no longer seemed to be talking in my voice or anyone else's. Now I would just sit here by myself on the sand and look out at the gulf and think about my daughter, Ilse Marie Fremantle, who had weighed 6 pounds and 4 ounces at birth, whose first word had been dog, who had once brought home a large brown balloon crayoned on a piece of construction paper, shouting exultantly, "I drawed a picture of you, Daddy." Ilse Marie Fremantle. I remember her well.